Maine Governor Paul LePage is again making controversial comments about the opioid crisis, and this time he's provoking reaction from some other governors. They're meeting at the annual Conference of New England Governors and Eastern Canadian Premiers in Boston. Yesterday's meeting was supposed to be largely about energy. But as WBUR's Shannon Dooling reports, LePage's comments about two Massachusetts cities became a bigger focus.
Governor LePage expanded on previous comments concerning the region's opioid crisis. He offered a racial breakdown of drug-related arrests in Maine. The governor says white Mainers are arrested for dealing methamphetamines, but he blames the sale of some other drugs on a different group of people.
The heroin fentanyl arrests are not white people. They're Hispanic and they're black and they're from Lowell and Lawrence, Massachusetts, Waterbury, Connecticut, the Bronx and Brooklyn. So I didn't make up the rules. That's how it turns out.
Governor LePage did not return to the afternoon session or closing press conference. If he had, he would have heard fellow governors take exception. Connecticut Governor Daniel Malloy did not hesitate in denouncing any attempt at pointing to race in connection with the region's opioid epidemic.
I think it is a great disservice to look at this as a racial issue. It is not. It should not be confused as one. And we need to be careful about not mixing race into this particular issue.
New Hampshire Governor Maggie Hassan urged a unified regional front in combating the crisis.
This is one of those moments where it doesn't matter which side of the border you're on. It doesn't matter which state you're in. It doesn't matter what walk of life you're from. This impacts everyone.
Asked for a comment on LePage's remarks, Governor Charlie Baker originally focused on what's being done to stem the epidemic, but later took issue with the Maine governor.
I think this is an issue that everybody in New England was dealing with it. And I said many, many, many times that this issue knows no neighborhood. It knows no race. It knows no class. It's as pervasive as anything I've ever seen in my 30 years in healthcare.
Baker says he's looking forward to more collaboration on addiction among the New England governors. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Shannon Dooling.
On the defensive and facing legal action, selectmen in the central Massachusetts town of Dudley are trying to win a second chance for the town zoning board to deal with a controversial plan for a Muslim cemetery. WBUR's David Boeri reports.
The selectmen initiated a plan in May to stop the cemetery. They won approval from town meeting to buy the parcel of land from underneath the Islamic Society of Greater Worcester. The board claimed the right of first refusal to buy the land from the owner who had agreed to sell it to the Muslim applicants. Facing the threat of a lawsuit and an investigation by the U.S. Attorney's Office for civil rights violations, the board has now decided unanimously to waive its claim of first refusal. It won't try to purchase the land. With this vote, the board hopes to win favorable action from a judge in state land court. That's where the Islamic Center filed suit after the Dudley Zoning Board denied them a special permit for the cemetery, saying the Muslims had no standing to apply. Special Attorney John Davis represents Dudley.
I'll raise this with the judge next Tuesday, but it may be appropriate for the judge to remand the case back to the ZBA to reopen the hearing that ended when the standing issue came up.
The attorney for the Islamic Society says the selectmen have taken the right step, but he is still concerned the zoning board is infringing on the religious rights of the Muslim applicants. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm David Boeri.
Historically, libraries have been collections, books, multimedia materials, and artwork. But increasingly, they're about connections, linking digital data in new and different ways. A state-of-the-art example is the Case Law Access Project at Harvard Law School Library. As WBUR's Bruce Gellerman tells us in this Bostonomics report, the law library is literally at the cutting edge of technology.
Not too long ago, a statement like this spoken in the hushed, hallowed hallways of Harvard Law School Library would have been considered heresy.
I think for court decisions, law books are becoming obsolete and even to some extent a hindrance.
Adam Ziegler is no heretic. He's managing director of the Library Innovation Lab at Harvard Law Library. He's leading a team of legal scholars and digital data workers in the school's Case Law Access Project.
We want the law, as expressed in court decisions, to be as widely distributed and as available as possible online to promote access to justice by means of access to legal information, but also to spur innovation, to derive new insights from the law that they've never been able to do when the law was kind of relegated to paper.
Harvard Law has lots of paper it wants to digitize. A barcode scanner inventories a law book, preparing it for a new future.
So what's going to result from this project is a huge database of electronic digital court decisions. And the world of law has never seen that before.
The school's collection, second only to the Library of Congress, includes the civil and criminal case law decisions from every state and federal court. Ziegler fans through one of the books.
Across all 43,000 books, we estimate an average of 921 pages per book.
That's about 40 million pages. The law school has so many books, the majority are in cold storage in a vast vault in a hidden hilltop repository in Southborough, out of sight and not very accessible by students and scholars. This is from a video documentary of the Tomb of Tomes, floored to ceiling shelves like something out of Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Placed on a computer-generated list, our book is retrieved by a human book picker strapped into a harness atop a mechanical lift.
Books to be digitized are shipped back to the law school. Adam Ziegler says the oldest decision in Harvard's case law collection dates back to Rhode Island's Court of Trials, circa 1647. He wants to extend its future forever.
We're all bound by the law. We're all bound by the decisions that judges issue. We ought to be able to read them, and we ought not have to pay to read them. Okay, so we're headed now into our prep room, which is where we disbind the books.
The goal of the Case Law Access Project is to liberate law books, making the contents available to anyone with an internet connection.
We are literally and sort of metaphorically unbinding the law and making it available online for free, which is exciting.
Zach Bodner, a digitalization specialist, uses an X-Acto knife, carefully cutting the case law book from its binding. Is that fun?
It does have a strange funness to it, indeed.
But after the fun comes the business end of a guillotine that slices neatly through the spine of the book.
The machine itself does chop with more force than a great white shark. A fun little tidbit.
All right, so we're now on the third floor of the library, and we're going to see the room where we do the scanning.
A high-speed scanner takes four different images of each page, 100,000 pages a day.
They also apply metadata that gives structure to the resulting file, so we know the name of the case, the name of the judges, the name of the court, the date on which the decision was issued, those key identifying characteristics in the key metadata.
The law book unbound, once scanned and metadata assigned, is hermetically sealed in plastic along with its original binding, using a device used by meatpackers. From here, the law book goes to a limestone cave in Kentucky. So come the apocalypse, some future archaeologists can judge the law book by its cover for eternity. Again, Adam Ziegler of Harvard Law School Library.
It's important to have it just in case, you know, if need be, if we need to reboot our democracy for some reason, then we'll have all these books in Louisville. But also, if we do our job right, then that book will be, you know, a backup that's only needed if something goes wrong.
The digital transformation turns the case law books into files that can be data mined and the information extracted for profit. Harvard has granted Ravel Law an 8-year exclusive contract to use the case law information. The law school has an equity interest in the California-based company, which plans to use the data in new and innovative ways. Daniel Lewis, CEO of Ravel, says it has applications that can detect trends and patterns in the law, even tracking bias among judges, presenting data in a visual way that discloses relationships never seen before in the law.
So you have this raw case that's now digital, and then what we can do is add machine learning on top of that. And by adding all these extra pieces of information, we make it more possible to sift through millions and millions of documents to find exactly what you want. And we do that by combining legal expertise with software engineering.
Ravel's applications turn case law data into legal narratives in a way the company says word search databases such as Lexis and Westlaw do not. And while accessing the raw data is free, the analysis is going to cost you. Harvard Law is the nation's oldest continuously operating law school. The library's Case Law Access Project should be completed by next March, in time for the school's bicentennial anniversary and a new chapter in the law school's future. For 90.9 WBUR and Bostonomics, I'm Bruce Gellerman.
In this week's installment of WBUR's Kind World series, we visit Fayetteville, North Carolina, where a local judge did something unusual after a sentencing. WBUR's Erica Lance explains the impact that the judge's unorthodox move had on the life of one veteran.
There's one day of Joe Cerna's life that has reverberated through every other day since. It's 2008. Joe's in Afghanistan, where he's serving in the Special Forces. He and three other guys are in an armored truck. It's big, with doors so heavy that you need a hydraulic system to open them. They're driving along a canal on a dirt road around midnight.
And at some point, the road gives away. The truck lands sideways and it starts sliding down the hill into the water. The water starts rising and coming up to my head, like over my head. I'm having trouble getting my seatbelt off.
His friend jumps back and yanks him up so he can breathe.
So the hydraulics is knocked out. And we are fighting for these doors and fighting for these doors. You can't see the water rising because it's pitch black. You can feel the water rising up to our chin. And then I hear a gurgling sound. And I realized that the fuel cans that we had on outside were crushed. And then I could smell the fumes. The only pocket of air I had was now contaminated. I kept coming in and out. I'd see things that weren't there, and I was hallucinating. I thought I had died.
Joe wakes up to a sharp tug. His team has found the truck. Someone pulls Joe out, and he starts walking up the hill, disoriented.
And I look to my left, and there's three bodies laying there. My friends. Everybody in the truck died. And so, that kind of crushed me.
Years later, Joe's out of the military, but that night in the truck echoes all around him. Something small, like a whiff of fuel, triggers nightmares. He can't bring himself to talk about his dead friends. So, Joe deals with his PTSD by drinking.
I wouldn't drink because I just liked the taste of beer. It was when I was angry, or if I was hurting.
Eventually, it lands him on probation for driving while intoxicated. And when he fails a urine test, despite the fact he's not allowed to drink, Joe lies to the judge. 2 weeks later, he's back in court.
I said, "Hey, Judge, I want to apologize to the court. I was dishonest about my use of alcohol."
I knew Joe had to be held accountable.
That's the judge, Lou Oliveira. He sentences Joe to a day in jail. But Lou is also a veteran, and he knows about Joe's past. So on the day Joe is supposed to report to jail, Lou decides to meet him there and reassure him.
When he showed up, I could tell visibly he was under distress.
Joe is shaking and sweating. Once he's in the cell, it gets worse.
This is a solid door. There's no bars. He closes the door, and it just kind of like echoed in my head, and I was so nervous. And we are fighting for these doors and fighting for these doors. I was in a truck again. Put my hands over my head and, you know, put my head down. I look to my left. Three bodies laying there. This is what it all comes to. Three bodies laying there. This is going to be the longest night of my life.
Then, Joe hears the door rattle.
I look up at the door, and standing right there is Judge Lou Oliveira with a big smile. And I kind of smiled too, because he was holding a tray of food.
Meatloaf and mashed potatoes.
He comes in and he sits on the bed. He says, "Scoot over." And I'm like, "What's up? You bringing me some food now, Judge?" He's like, "No, I'm staying here." I'm like, "Staying where?" He's like, "I'm staying in the cell with you." I said, "You're going to stay here in the cell with me the entire time." He says, "That's what we're going to do."
I called up my wife and said, "Honey, I'm not coming home for dinner." "Well, why not?" I said, "Well, I'm going to jail."
When I seen him and I seen his smile, it automatically brought me back to being a person. I was overwhelmed. I really wanted to cry. And I didn't feel alone. And not only that, he slept on the ground. I said, "Judge, if anything, please sleep on the bunk. Let me take the ground." He says, "I got it."
Then they talk for hours.
Finally, Joe's breathing got heavier and he got quieter. And then he started to snore. That was when I felt good, because I knew Joe would be okay.
The next morning, Lou drives Joe home before heading right back to the courthouse.
When I walked out of cell, it felt like a clean slate. I was talking to one of the jailers, and I'm like, "Have you ever seen that?" He's like, "No." He said, "Don't disappoint him."
Joe says one of the hardest parts of coping with his memories has always been trust. He didn't trust people anymore. But Lou changed that.
Just his presence alone shifted my whole mindset. When he walked in, that kind of brought the walls down and built this confidence in me, trust in people.
In this case, it took 12 hours and a judge in jail to give Joe new direction. How will you spend your next 12? For 90.9 WBUR and Kind World, I'm Erica Lantz.
You can hear more Kind World stories about the effect one act of kindness can have by subscribing to the Kind World podcast or at WBUR.org. You can share a story of kindness yourself by sending an email to kindworld@WBUR.org.